So welcome everybody to the Radical Reference panel called Compensation, Access, and Theft, Copyright in the 21st Century. We will have a follow-up of links and maybe notes. If, as people mention resources, we'll put that on the Radical Reference site. Radical Reference, by the way, is a collective of librarians and library workers and library school students that try to answer reference questions and otherwise do sort of information services for activists. Before I introduce the panelists, I just wanted to get a sense too of who's in the room. So how many of you are publishers? And that could be whether you're a zinester or a book publisher or you're on a blog. So our panelists are raising their hands. How many of you are librarians or in other ways responsible for collecting content in some way? So very few other hands. How many of you are authors? Books, blog posts, articles? Okay, so we've got maybe a third of the room. And how many of you are readers? Okay, good. So everybody's raising their hand. Okay, so our five-member panel here, everybody, I will introduce people, and everybody will speak for about 5 minutes, which isn't very long, I'm afraid. And I'll wave if it looks like you need to wind down. And then we'll just have Q&A, so hopefully we'll have a good discussion. So I'm going to introduce everybody. So first we have Vicky Law, who is a writer, photographer, zinester, and mother. She's the author of the book Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, which was published by PM Press in 2009. And she's also the editor-publisher of the zine Tenacious, Art and Writings from Women in Prison. And we have Jim Fleming, who is a member of the Autonomedia Editorial Collective. We have Craig O'Hara, who's the co-founder of PM Press and the Tabling Tornadoes. He's spent the last 15 years publishing and selling radical independent books to bookstores, as well as directly to readers online, and also at book fairs, academic conferences, protests, and rock concerts. We have Alika Jirasi, who is a librarian and a member of Radical Reference as well. She's also a graduate student in labor studies at CUNY, and she is the co-author of the forthcoming book, Grassroots Library Advocacy, being published by ALA Editions. And finally, we have Carl Fogel, who's from the organization questioncopyright.org. He's an open source developer, author, and copyright reform activist. So I figured we would start in order of from the creative process out, so we're going to begin with our author, Vicky Law.
Okay. Hey everybody, thanks for coming. So as Melissa said, I publish and edit a zine called Tenacious, Art and Writings from Women in Prison. I originally started writing and getting my words out there as a zinester, not necessarily as an author or a writer for magazines or anything that would have financial compensation, so my writing is always been a form of getting political ideas out there into the world and getting some of the little heard voices and realities that we're not hearing about out there. And it wasn't necessarily about making a living or anything having to do with me personally. And one of the things that I realized as I moved from doing zines to writing for magazines and then eventually writing a book is that as a zinester, you have total creative control over your product. You have control over what it looks like, how often it'll come out, how big it'll be, how much you can charge for it, et cetera, et cetera. But you also have this limited distribution. Like, it's on you to get that out there. So if I don't feel like going to 15 years worth of rock concerts, book fairs, everything else, then that means my words and my ideas and what I'm trying to get out there isn't going to be reaching like a large number of people in society. And when I first started writing my book and I got involved with PM Press, which published my book, one of the things that I immediately realized was writing a book is this much longer process, and maybe Craig and Jim can talk about like what goes on during this process of like me submitting something and then basically sitting on my hands and waiting. And I realized that I didn't have as much control, but I had a way to reach a much larger audience than I would have if I was just me with a computer and a copying machine, getting my words out there as zines. What I also found out later on in the book process is that with the press like PM, I got more control over what my book was going to look like and what the content was going to be than with other presses. I've since talked to other small press authors who said, you know, I didn't actually get control over what was going to be on my cover or what my title was going to be or even what my content was going to be. So sometimes publishers would demand that you would actually change the content so it would be more marketable or more accessible to a larger number of people who would buy it. And finally, and I'm sorry this kind of like goes in all different directions, but I kind of wanted to address some of the guiding questions. Since one of the questions is about compensation, I wanted to say that as a political writer, it was never about getting paid, or it was never about compensation. It was about getting my ideas out there into the world and getting certain messages across that wouldn't necessarily be picked up by more mainstream publishers or necessarily got me paid to do that. And I think that anyone who wants to go through through the process of publishing a book, especially when you're talking about publishing a political book, needs to remember that and ask themselves, why are they putting this effort forth? Why are they actually doing all this work of publishing, of writing, of editing, and publishing? Is it to get paid and make a name for yourself, or is it to get an idea out there? And if it is to like get paid and make a name, then you should ask yourself, well, is this the way to do it? Because with political writing, although I actually have gotten some royalties from PM Press, and again, maybe like Jim and Craig can talk about like how royalties work and stuff like that. If you were to add up all the hours I've spent on compiling the material that went into my book and all the years that I've spent working with incarcerated women to get to the point where I had a book, you know, like the couple of hundred dollars I've gotten, obviously doesn't cover it. It adds up to like, what, 2 cents per every hour. So it's not about, you know, like getting rich or getting famous, but it's about getting something out there. Thanks.
Thank you, Barry. So Jim?
I'm a member of the editorial collective of a small press called Autana Media, and I guess the founder and publisher. It's about 28 years old, and we've published about 350 books, I think, over that amount of time. Of those 350 books, maybe about 20 have actually made money. So the odds of having a commercially successful book of the kind that we publish are quite slim. We have a kind of house policy that has developed over the years. It wasn't in place at the start, of trying to encourage our books to be explicitly anti-copyright. If authors agree to that, we adopt that principle. But not all authors are ready to do that. Some of our writers hope to make money from their writing. We do contract for certain books with writers and pay royalties. But as I said, the commercial success of our books is often very small. So as a consequence, not many writers have actually made a lot of money from any deals with us. We try to make sure writers know this well ahead, because many writers have illusions about how successful their work might be. I guess I would say, I've been trying to think about how I would try to phrase this issue or pitch this issue about just compensation for work. Certainly, I think it would be good if writers were paid for their work, but if writers really want to be paid for their work, they shouldn't be publishing at the margins where work just generally isn't commercially viable. In a kind of more utopian frame of mind, I would say I don't think writers should be paid at all for their work. I don't think anybody should be paid for their work because I don't think anybody should work. But on a day-to-day basis, I have a lot of trouble living by this premise. I certainly fail to meet that standard myself, but not because I'm paid for my publishing work, which is all volunteer. I have a very precarious part-time teaching position that keeps some amount of food on my table. The politics of copyright have gotten more complex recently because of the challenges that new media have posed to the traditional forms of print dissemination. In 1998, a Mickey Mouse Copyright Act was passed that extended the active term of copyright control, largely because the Disney Corporation was about to lose the earliest film rights of Mickey Mouse. And they certainly spearheaded an enormous political campaign to extend the active term of copyright. So copyright has become much more politicized as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of the kind of threat that many traditional media corporations detected because of the changes of modern technology. I guess threats that are probably best exemplified by what happened to the recording music recording industry, since it's now really just a shadow of its former self because of the ability to pirate music online. I have no instant conclusion, but I'm happy to answer questions or comment more later on.
Thank you, Jim. Craig?
Okay. I have very little to add to what Vicki and Jim said. I will echo their points that there is literally no chance to make a living on publishing or writing radical literature. I worked for AK Press for 10 years, and I've worked for PM Press for the last 3 years, and the bulk of the work that we do is done by volunteers, people who do not get paid, or they're done by people who are willing to do self-exploitation labor, which I don't actively encourage people to do unless it's they want to spread a political message that they feel is underrepresented. Otherwise, there's certainly no money in it. And you know, again, my experiences have mostly been very similar to Jim's as a grassroots sort of political publisher. We are different than a lot of other sort of left-wing publishers or nonprofit publishers in that we do pay set royalties to our authors twice a year. And I'm definitely happy to give folks any details about how we do this. Every contract with an author is different. Standard, we pay them 10 to 15% of net sales. Occasionally there'll be a small advance. Again, nothing for anyone to live off of. We also do CDs and DVDs, which have different discount schedules. They have different royalty rates. In these cases, people who do DVDs often go out of pocket up to $100,000 to do their own films. And if they get $5,000 back, it's considered very lucky. So there is no money in that realm to do it. We do try our best to work with authors who are extremely active. So in a case with someone like Vicki Law, if she sees any money from her book, it's because we're selling them to her at a good discount, and she's selling them to you at full price. So we have to work with people who don't expect to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show or to have their book raised up Amazon or whatnot. There have to be people who are doing, like we're doing our best to kick ass and get out there and get the message out there, put it out to the public ourselves. A lot of the issues around copyright and being able to make any money are around distribution. A lot of them are around selling foreign rights, which we do quite a bit of, where we'll split the money with an author if we sell any kind of serial rights, whether it's foreign rights or magazine rights or whatnot. The world of e-books has opened up a whole new world of copyrights. We work with authors like Cory Doctorow, who just want everything for free and don't even want any royalties for the writing, which they can do because they already have enough money. We work with people like Ursula Lagoon, who is a strict copyright person, who everything has to be DRM, and she's also already got enough money. So people have very different takes on it. My personal opinion is that we are far more afraid of the stuff we publish being ignored than we're afraid of it being pirated. So we don't put DRM on our ebooks unless the author demands it. I very rarely see anyone pirating our books, but if we did, I'd be happy to look the other way if that meant the message was getting out there. I says we have about 10 people working with PM Press now. We pay out annually salaries. We probably pay out about $50,000. Royalties, we probably pay out about $150,000. So, the authors are always getting more than the people who do the publishing, but they're also working for years and years and years to do one release. And it's not just the author. There's someone who does a book cover. And the copyright issues with people who do book covers, who do cover arts, who do the photographs of books. These are all very complex issues, and we have been taken to court and lost, where people have said, you've used our image for your book cover, and we didn't get paid enough, and you sold too many of the books, and now we're going to sue you. And we've had a lot of bad dealings, and I don't believe we've ever won a copyright case, in fact. So I think when you talk about a book or a DVD or anything, you're also talking about the cover, you're talking about how it's presented in the catalog, you're talking about how it's presented in advertising. All of these things could have a dozen copyrights involved with every release that you do. And it's a mess. It's a complete mess. I also I wrote a book myself about 20 years ago, which sold about 20,000 copies. So I actually got money from doing a book once. So I know it is possible if you push hard enough.
Cool. So on that positive.
Right.
So Alika.
All right, I'm gonna kind of follow everybody in giving a little bit about my background and then segue into the first question around compensation and authorship and publishing. So very similar to Vicky, I started out as a consumer of radical publishers, radical authors, moved into becoming a zinester, a zine librarian, and then moved as I professionalized my background, became a librarian. I moved into working in a radical and labor library that served the radical labor and scholarly community in New York City. So I have a history of working with ideas, not product necessarily. And through that, I became a public librarian in New York City. So at this point, I work in one of the largest systems in the country that has the highest circulation in the country. But at the same time, it was my introduction to working with centralized purchasing models, working with large book publishers that do not provide access to a lot of independent publishers, certainly not radical publishers, and that also adhere to institutional policies that kind of protect and strengthen intellectual property rights and copyright law. So, every day I'm pulled between being able to provide access to information on truly a mass scale. When we talk about serving the masses, that's what public libraries do. But also being restricted by a purchasing and acquisition and access model that restricts the nature of information that we can look at and view and borrow and bring home. So my question is also, how do you take access into account when we're talking about compensation? Also, often we're talking about a trade-off between the ability to provide authors with compensation, with publishers and the people that do the work and the publishing companies. How can they be paid for their labor, yet still provide access on a large scale? And at this point, a lot of libraries don't really have that worked out because we're stuck in these, corporate-dominated purchasing models. But to piggyback on what Jim was saying earlier, there really is no such thing as fair compensation under capitalism. And a lot of radical publishers have dealt with that by saying, okay, there's no money here. None of us are going to make any money. And and that's just how it is, and you have to limit your expectations if you want to publish with a radical publisher and have these fringe ideas, this fringe product. And but that's different than the publishing model that exists with mainstream publishers, where largely, with the exception of, you know, rock star authors who can kind of command their price on the market, you know, publishing companies do get a certain, a very large percentage of the purchase price. Give a smaller percentage of the purchase price to the author, but overall author compensation is determined by sales, you know, not the amount of time, say, Vicky spent writing her book or coming up with the life experience that gave her the knowledge to write the book, and not the social or intellectual value of the work itself. You're basically an author working on commission. You know, it's sales-based, it's market-based. There's, you know, an inherent fault in that. So in discussing the concept of how we create this idea of fair compensation in the radical publishing community is, how do we define fair or equitable? Is it percentage of revenue that is returned to the author? Is it the idea of ownership rights, how ownership reverts to the author, you know, after the sales run concludes? Or is it based on the overall purchase price? Because we're also talking about a product that doesn't generate a lot of money, especially when we're talking about low sales figures, which is how it is when you're serving the radical community. So I think radical publishers can benefit from the fact that there is a lot of loyalty generated in the community. I don't think, say, HarperCollins can say, oh, let's have a benefit for me. You know, we're having a hard time right now. You know, buy some t-shirts, help me out. Radical publishers, you know, there's loyalty, and there's also a certain amount of trust that is based on the belief that, you know, they're not out there for the money. They're out there to provide access to ideas, to not screw over authors, that whatever money is out there is going to kind of be spread around, even if it means everybody gets $5, you know, and not 5,000. So the question returns to what best resembles fair compensation, and I do think it centers around ownership, equitable division of percentage, and then the ability to provide the greatest amount of access. And we have to balance those.
Well, thank you, Alisa. So, Carl?
Sure. So I'll give a quick background, a little bit about myself and about our organization, and then actually, I've been furiously taking notes here, give the rest of my 5 minutes responding to some of the things that have been said, because I think that's the best way to introduce the ideas that our organization represents. So I come from a computer programming background in the open source free software world, which most of you probably know, and it's nice to have a crowd where that's the case and I don't have to explain it. So that's essentially a copyright-free zone. I realize that's an oversimplification for the lawyers in the room, but copyright has no restrictive effects in that zone, so for all practical purposes, it's copyright-free. From that, I started applying those principles to other areas of my life and to things beyond software, and really began to sort of feel the handcuffs, the fact that I couldn't just pick up a book and if I thought it, you know, chapter two needed work, I couldn't just go edit it the way I could with a software program, which I, you know, I wasn't going to claim that I had written the book, or I wasn't going to pass off my editing as the author's work or something, but I couldn't even do that. I couldn't just modify and redistribute. QuestionCopyright.org was founded to give the public, and especially artists and their audiences, a framework for understanding the effects of copyright that is similar to the way free software and open source developers might understand it from personal experience. So the idea that copying something is not theft, that plagiarism, that is the theft of credit, is completely unrelated to simply modifying and redistributing and sharing. It is not what copyright law prevents. And it's not really a problem. When your works circulate freely on the internet, you don't have a plagiarism problem because it's so easy to find the originals. So we put out various things. You can go to questioncopyright.org and see some of our videos and our articles and our programs that we run. I want to talk now from personal experience and kind of defeat your organization of this panel by putting on my author hat, because I'm an author. Sorry. But I think this will maybe give you a sense of how different things can be. And this is a model in which there is a role for publishers, and I have great respect, especially for the small publishers that have really sacrificed themselves, you know, and they've self-exploited for many years to put out works they thought were important, and that I don't think that will ever change. That's going to be going on for as long as people make books, whether those books are electronic or not. I've written two books, the first in 1999, the second in 2005. They're both about the software field, and the second one is basically about how you do open source projects from a social and sort of how to manage volunteers and things like that. I put them out under open copyrights. They're basically under a share alike license. And I was paid. My publisher paid me. It's O'Reilly Media. That means I got an advance check, and I got royalties. The royalties slowly paid back the advance, and I finally crossed the line about 6 months ago, and I've been getting actual like royalty checks. 100 or 200 every quarter, or something like that. So it's not a huge amount of money, but it was enough to make me feel that I had to buy more than pizza. But I also put those books online for free downloading and copying and everything. And then it's, you know, commercial activity is permitted. It's fine. They're really free, as in freedom. What happened was that my little niche book, which I can't even recommend that most of you read because you don't need it, was translated into more languages than most more deserving books that I can think of. My readership went through the roof. It's insane. I mean, if my purpose was to get my message out there and to, you know, I've got all these quotes written down from the other people on the panel about how the point was not compensation, it was to get out a message that you might feel is underrepresented, etc. Well, this method really, really worked. And I know that because nobody had to ask me for permission when they wanted to translate or recast, there have been some small derivative works based on parts of my book. They just went ahead and did it. And it didn't affect my market at all, really. My publisher continues to sell. People who buy from that publisher know that I get paid. There are other publishers who have put out the book without paying me. They don't have much market share because they didn't have the first market advantage. And it's pretty clear from looking at them, looking at my publisher, which one is paying me. And I'm careful to always be accurate about that. I think what we need is accurate information. That is, people should be able to know when they buy a book at all. And I kind of believe that access to all books should be free. That is, the purchase price should be a voluntary set price by the reader. But when people do pay, they should be able to know that whoever they are paying, they should know how much of that is going to the author. And it turns out, and I'm not the only example, our artist in residence at questioncoverage.org, Nina Paley, has had the same experience on a much larger scale economically, that when people have that information, they go right to the route that will get the most money to the author, and they use that. So I'm not sure why, if our purpose is to spread our message and to get important stuff out there, why we would do anything at all to limit the spread of our works. It doesn't make sense to me.
Thank you very much. So this room presents great challenges for looking at the panel. So I'm actually going to move to the back. And if there's a little, I'm vacating a chair, so if you want to scuffle a bit, you want to not have to stand. But so why don't we take questions?
I have a burning question. Should Amy Goodman have published with Disney from her own point of view, for the point of view of her words, or for the point of view of her community? What do you think of, I mean, and not to pick on Amy Goodman, but just in general, someone who,
yeah,
should she publish with Autonomy Media?
She's published with a press called Hyperion, which is belongs to Disney. I've always wondered why she decided to do that. The only thing I can imagine is that she believed she would reach a bigger audience than she might otherwise from the small press perspective, which is almost certainly true. But I always felt it was sort of fundamentally a political mistake to have done that. She's certainly not alone. There are many authors whose message is quite radical who have neglected to publish with the small press. And it always feels to me like it changes what they say. You know, a book published by a commercial press means something different than if it's published by a radical press. even though the books may be identical, it just delivers a different message.
I'm going to jump in with a quick commentary that this idea that there's one publisher for every book is part of this centralized system. That is, it could be a world where Disney is perfectly free to publish Amy Goodman's book, but so is PM Press or Autonomy Media.
Yeah.
And then you guys can simply be transparent about who is sharing what with Amy Goodman and which one she likes more.
We've published the small number of books, I'm sure less than 10% of the books that we've published that have made money, have in fact been explicitly anti-copyright. Some of them are now in 25 languages, but we've never had any deals with foreign presses to be compensated for foreign editions. So that's certainly one factor in our ability to maintain, to be too small to fail.
Should we take more questions?
Question? Yeah.
Come on, we had sparks flying.
I just have a question for Vicki. How have you worked out the copyright rights of the women, the incarcerated women, who have been towards your published?
So, I don't quite know how this fits into copyright, so I'll talk about consent. You know, using their words, is that when I first got offered a book deal from PM, I wrote, I've been compiling all this information about incarcerated women's resistance and organizing in U.S. prisons. So they knew I'd been doing a zine. Many of them had written for the zine. They knew that originally I had been working on a paper for college and that a lot of their work was going into this college paper. And they knew when I started writing articles for some of the radical magazines like Punk Planet and Clamor Magazine that their words were going into that. Then I said, well, I got this book deal. And I would love to use your stories and experiences. And so here's my question. A, can I use them? B, would you like me to use your real name? Or would you like me to use a pseudonym? And if so, which pseudonym? However, one of the ways in which I was able to track down some of these stories was because women had used their real names in the past when sharing stories and experiences, which enabled me to be able to get in touch with them and say, hey, I heard that you had gone on a 30-day hunger strike to be moved to a prison closer to your children, so you weren't 300 miles away from your children and weren't able to see them for 10 and a half years. And I was only able to do that because there was a newspaper article or somebody else had written about them and it had their real name. Otherwise, like Mary Smith, you know, in some unnamed prison is never going to have her, you know, be able to like say more about that experience. And then I said, and if you agree to have your stories and experiences be shared, I will send you a copy of every single chapter that it appears in so that you can tell me, get rid of this, you can't have that, you know, change my name, no, this is inaccurate, here's an update, and that's what I did. So it was a lot of back and forth. So like, you know, like every single woman who agreed got copies of the chapters sent to them. They would write back and they would like cross things out or they'd be like, hey, this is inaccurate, or hey, this is an update, or actually, I don't want the whole world to know I got sexually assaulted by a guard, so please give me a pseudonym in this chapter, but keep my name in this chapter. And then I would make all those changes and I would send it back to them. You know, so it was and with some women it was like a very it was a one-time process, and with some women it was a back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So they were happy with the way that they felt I was representing their stories and experiences.
You gave them rights to the copy.
Yeah, I guess so. But so that was what I did. You know, whether or not that like falls under any sort of like copyright, I don't know.
If they never signed an agreement giving you copyright, then they are the owners, they're sort of the owners of their stories, but you're the owner of your expression of the stories. It's kind of complicated.
Okay.
But I don't think it's going to become an issue for you or the rest.
I have a question. It's not strictly related to copyright, but about the ethics of libraries as purchasers dealing with small presses, because I sort of have these ethical questions and, arise in the course of my own purchasing for a book in my library. I buy these small press art books from Latin American publishers, and the publishers are called Gatoneras, and they have a community collective where they produce book covers out of recycled cardboard, and they usually get stories or articles donated by authors, so it's sort of copyright free. Not copyright free, but you know, distribution, right? So I can't buy them directly because I can't get them to issue me a purchase order, right? So I can't buy from small publishers unless they can deal with me on that level. But I have vendors who will pick them up for me. But I know they're paying these publishers 50 cents for the book or less. And then they charge me 20 bucks.
Yes.
And I don't want to do business in that way. What do we do? But I need to provide access to these items for scholars in the U.S. But I'm conflicted. I mean, what? How do you address that sort of thing? Like, do we give these publishers, these vendors, this ginormous markup at the expense of the smaller collectors?
Set up your own subsidiary and generate the purchase orders.
For
become that middleman and then do what you want.
Yeah, that's a nightmare. I'm dealing internationally.
That reminds me of the issues a lot of libraries have gone through in setting up zine collections, in setting up mechanisms in which the libraries can continue to purchase in the manner to which they've become accustomed. But it's involved either zine authors or zine distributors creating a mechanism for libraries to do that. It doesn't, as far as I know, the libraries haven't facilitated that directly. And I think that's the question, is how willing are the actual creators of the content willing to go to have you collect their work? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, honestly, it's not an issue I deal with because my institution has centralized purchasing to the point where we are only allowed to purchase books from one vendor. This is public library acquisitions in the U.S.
That's Baker and Taylor.
This is very common. It is Baker and Taylor. Baker and Taylor, period. But academic libraries, special libraries, even a lot of smaller public library systems still have the freedom to purchase from a variety of vendors. I don't know. But it's an ethical quandary. That, I mean, all I can say is what I would do if I was in that situation, which would be to try to, on my own time, try to create a way for them to receive the bulk of the funds, not a vendor.
And I actually do make my own invoices when buying books from Zinesters.
Yeah, well, Rutgers is a state university. You have all kinds of ethics issues. They would never allow me to do something like that.
Yeah.
I would love to.
as long as we're dominated by the money form, these kind of ethical issues are pretty much inescapable. But I guess it's another utopian note, but we really have to get out of the money form, which I guess, in practical terms, means something like systems of barter or exchange that aren't monetized.
Libraries used to have a lot of those, but it became too expensive to maintain in terms of staff. We had exchange programs, huge exchange programs, because it's almost impossible to get international publications otherwise. But those, I mean, hardly any libraries maintain those anymore because the staff cost is just so high.
More questions?
One practical note about authors and rights issues. Authors should be wary, or at least cognizant, of the technological changes that make it possible now for books to never really go out of print, because print on demand now makes it possible to do micro runs. So if you got a book deal with some publisher who you think might not have your own best interests at heart, the idea that you might eventually regain the rights to your own work when a book goes out of print could conceivably not ever happen again. It used to be that publishers would have to commit a certain amount of money to do a reprint of an edition, and if they judged that the sales had lagged sufficiently that a new edition wasn't commercially viable for them, they would allow the rights to revert to the authors. But now they could just keep a few copies permanently available. So that's not really much of an option anymore. So if you're an author expecting that could happen, you really have to trust your publisher more, because they could just keep a few copies around forever.
It really sounds like, I mean, what the problems we're describing are not money problems, they're monopoly problems.
Yeah.
You know, It's the presence of money in the system isn't the problem. It's the presence of this rule that one party at a time has the exclusive right to print or copy something. That's where.
Well, I think there's a deeper and more fundamental problem about money as well.
There's sort of a clean, one can make a clean separation in this particular area. I would also prefer if humans didn't have to work, and particularly work for someone else for learning. Which isn't a slur on my employer, but, they all feel that way, right?
I was wondering, you guys mentioned self-exploitation a couple times, and if you can sort of speak to the sustainability, right? Of, we're talking about a fringe movement and fringe authorship and fringe messages that need to be out there and potentially need to be out there for quite a long time, and for these big issues to actually come to seed. And so, I don't know, I'm a little nervous or anxious about this concept of self-exploitation as a just thing that we have to deal with. Or something that must be accepted and move on with.
Most authorship is self-exploitation. It is very, very rare for an author to really earn their living, or to even make more than, say, minimum wage per hour worked on the book, or whatever it is that they work on. It's, the norm is this kind of exploitation, and people do it for other reasons. I knew I wasn't going to make much money on the book, but I knew that it would help my reputation and lead to various connections that I wanted to have happen, and sort of, it would make my name, which is different from making money, and in that sense it did. So there are authors who have written more and probably better books in this panel, so I'll turn it over to them.
Oh, you're looking at
me? Yes, actually.
Okay. Well, like I said before, I didn't write this book to I want to make money off it, I want to get paid. I wrote a book specifically about resistance and organizing in women's prisons in the U.S. with the understand, because when I was an undergrad in college, I looked all over the place for something that talked about women's uprisings and women's rebellions and women's riots and other forms of organizing and resistance, and I wasn't finding it. So it's kind of the quote, if there's a book that you want to read that doesn't exist yet, you have to write it. And after going through, and I went to Brooklyn College, and they had an fabulous interlibrary loan system, unlike the public library that, loses my interlibrary loan system things. But I got access to all these different books that other universities have. So it's kind of like some university in Iowa or Oklahoma or whatever. As long as I knew the title and the author of the book, I could interlibrary loan it. And even the books I interlibrary loaned from these academic institutions that weren't available in the public library system didn't have much of the information I was looking for. It was really, academic, dry, theoretical, talked a lot about women's issues, but they weren't talking about what I was looking for that I was seeing in men's prison literature. Mm-hmm. And so, this idea that, I was writing this book, not to be compensated, but because I was this needs to be out there, and this is also a part of this work that I do, that's anti-prison work and looking at, the bigger picture of prison. So, again, like I said, it took me 7.5 years to write this book, and so, if the $200-something that PM Press paid me, it'd be look, we sold books, maybe there's a math whiz in this room, 7.5 years, figure I spent an average of 2 hours a day on this book, divided by 200, let's say it's $250, you can kind of do the math and
you paid money to write your book.
How much I got paid for it. So, and if I had been an author that maybe wanted compensation and wanted to make a living from it, I would have written a very different women in prison book that would have been more exploitative and would have been the shit that you see in the drugstore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Comment on this. Yeah, I think that goes a little bit to your question, but there's a radical book fair in New York, and we're a radical publisher, and we put these books out because we think the ideas are very important and we want to spread them. But I think what we would probably all agree on is that the culture we're in now doesn't value any sort of music or film or literature. So we're self-exploiting ourselves, and we justify it because we have this political position, we need to get it out. But if I was interested in self-help books, history of language books, cookbooks, there's still no money in them for anybody. If you go to any major book fair where there's a authors tend to self-published authors, they're not pushing radical materials. They're doing their short story collection, grandma's recipes, whatever it is. Mainstream ideas in publishing and in music, if you're a group and you play pop music, that does not mean you're going to make a living or have any fans or sell any records. The culture doesn't value art. So it's not that much different whether it's radical art or not radical art. It's going to be self-exploitation. If you play in a band that does Jimmy Buffett covers, you're going to rehearse for years and years and years till you get that gig at the, you know, Tiki Lounge or whatever. It's never going to pay off in capitalist terms.
Best example ever.
It's never going to pay off if your role is to be an artist, whether an activist or not.
Also, one thing that's interesting is like this idea that compensation is always monetary. I mean, I was thinking about that as I was walking over here, like, why aren't we thinking of compensation as, and I mean, I don't know how this would work in terms of publishing. I'm kind of interested in this idea of a barter system, you know, that, you know, like, it's like, why can't that be like, somebody comes over and like, or I go over to somebody's house and I can work on my, like, whatever I'm writing while somebody's cooking me a meal. So I don't actually have to do that kind of work to be like, I obviously need to eat at some point, you know, in my day, you know, or like somebody's like, hey, I'll go hang out with your kid, you know, for 4 hours, you know, like, so you can not only work on your book, but maybe you can go to the movies, you know, like afterwards kind of thing, like, you know, or something that's not necessarily like, here's $5, here's $10, there's like this monetary value, but like compensation in other ways that enrich our lives and make us less, you know, like make us rely less on like this idea that like everything's got to have a dollar value. So like I'd be kind of interested if people had thoughts on that too.
One thing also that I think is missing from our discussion is that we keep going around and talking about it as being choices that individual authors make and that publishers make to exist on this model, to self-exploit. But, you know, this is a social relationship we have, you know, this creation of a, you know, radical idea space in which books are read and discussed and passed around and shared and copied and all of that. So if we want to see a different model in which authors and publishers can, you know, eat and pay rent, then we have to create it. And whether that be being willing to pay more for a book or a copy of a book or pay for to see an author speak or create some kind of sharing of resources so that people can continue to do this work or move to, you know, alternative systems like, you know, micro-patronage or things in which, you know, artists create, you know, some kind of donation system that will fund their work for a certain period of time. But, you know, without that discussion that this is a community issue, we're not going to move into different models. Because it's not just on authors and publishers to create an alternative.
I think there's, why don't you go ahead?
Oh, okay. I was just wondering if you're ever approached by authors who aren't US citizens or permanent resident aliens, and like, if you had the opportunity to compensate them monetarily, what are like the legal hoops you have to jump through in order to legally compensate someone who's not being a citizen or as an alien living here? Or are you just not approached by such authors?
Are you addressing me and my organization?
Yeah.
Well, we have the reverse situation where people outside the U.S. want to send money to one of the people we work with, usually our artists in residence, but sometimes some of the musicians we work with too. But either way, I mean, the issue there is really just one of how hard is it to transfer money internationally, and the answer is it kind of depends on what banks you use and how big an amount you're trying to transfer and how often you're doing it.
Oh, but I mean, if someone is living here, let's say like an author is living here and they want, you know, you to publish their book or something, can you legally compensate them for it or not?
Well, I don't see any reason why not. I mean, I guess I'm not sure I understand what the barrier would be. You mean if somebody is not legally allowed to receive income in the United States?
Well, if someone is in the United States, let's say they're on an H-1 visa or something, let's say they're sponsored by the bank they work for. And is it a gray area that there's some books can you jump through to compensate them for the book they work?
For me, it's a gray area because I just don't know. That hasn't come up for us.
So far as I know, the only real hurdle is that, and this is not special about publishing, it's just about income. If you're a freelancer or a writer or anybody working for someone else, when you reach a certain amount of payment, the employer is obliged to file some kind of document about how much money you've received. So if you were to get royalties above a certain level, any employer or any royalty payer is obliged to report that you've received a certain amount of money. So whether you're a freelance writer or a casual employee in any industry. But I don't think there's any hurdles about making a contract or making an arrangement for anyone to publish anyone's work in any, here or abroad.
I think it's different for employment versus a contract. It's illegal for someone who doesn't have permission to work to get a job and work. But if you're just buying and selling something you've got, a book, it's like going into a store and buying and selling something.
Well, you're paying royalties. There are complications if you're paying. You have to get their social security number if you're paying above a certain amount of proof. I guess we've all, the two publishers that I am, or sort of a publisher in some ways, have had to go through this. You have to get various information about them. So it's not strictly a contract issue. Oh, legal changes? It's hard to get Congress to do anything, but I'm sure anything can happen. But yeah.
But okay, so there's.
Yeah, but it's yeah, paying people is complicated.
No, it's Nance. We wire money all over the world to people who live all over the world legally. If you're an American citizen, we need your social security number, and we're a legal company, we report that as taxable income. If you're not, we give you the money, you report it if you want to. We don't care.
It's not your problem.
It's not a problem, yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's just when it comes to like publishing or creating some kind of art that you want to disseminate, it's just a confusing gray area for me, because like, for example, I'm on an H-1B, and that I'm 100% tied to the organization that is sponsoring that H-1B for me. I've been approached by other organizations, I've been asked to be freelance for them, and I have to say no, because I'm not legally allowed to get money from anyone except that organization.
Yeah.
And my hands are bound. And I don't know what that means.
Well, if you can still stay, if you stay below a certain level, I have this antique sense that it's something like $600 a year. It's probably higher. Is it 600? If you earn less than $600 from any potential employer, they're not obliged to report anything for you. If they pay you more than $600 a year, they're supposed to file. So
so it's about amount.
It's about amount. If you stay really down low, then you don't have a paper trail.
But I think it's important to emphasize that none of this is about copyright. There's absolutely no restriction, in the U.S. at least, on whether somebody can, like you can make a work available to someone and they can print it or burn DVDs or whatever it is. Like it's all about the payment.
This is not
the publishing. This is the we do actually have freedom of speech, and that's a good thing. So that part is not about the issue, and even independently of the copyright questions.
Yeah.
There's one there.
Going back to whether the copyright issue is a monopoly problem or money problem, and I have to think it's more of a monopoly, but the money is a part of it. I know this is a broad question. Obviously, I'm not looking for like a quick 5-minute answer to this, but I'm just like, I don't know, general thoughts on like how best to sort of counter this monopoly on copyrights that like, you know, corporations and states have. I don't know, just suggestions.
I mean, our organization is all about that issue. So since anyone could go to our website, I'd like other people to maybe take that first. I can jump in if nobody wants to.
I'll take the institutional perspective. I think when we're talking about libraries, which are institutions that provide access to very large population groups, because they're institutions, they're naturally risk adverse. So I think any huge changes that are going to happen, we're going to follow. We're not going to lead on that. There may be discourse in the professional community that challenges the ethical implications of copyright, of digital rights management, of ebook policy, all of those things. but the policy, the borrowing, the access policy isn't going to change until it's already been challenged and institutions can be assured that they're not going to be sued. So I don't think we're going to see changes on that level coming first. You're going to have to change it on, you know, begin to challenge it from the fringe on individual levels and build it from there. Then you'll see, you know, broader changes.
We did see it in software.
I mean, it actually happened, right? Yes.
So we know this can work.
Exactly. And that's slowly filtering into the mainstream. Just the very idea that you can question these ideas of ownership and of proprietary information. But it takes time.
Yeah.
Seen in software, we're seeing a huge resistance in the library world to control over, you know, ebook materials. But it's going to take time, and for institutions to feel assured that they can make these changes and be supported by, you know, the broader community.
More questions? How are we doing on time, by the way?
Oh, we have about a half hour.
Oh, awesome. Because I can pontificate if y'all don't
No, actually, that reminded me when you said there's this resistance in the beginning of the open source software movement. You had to find companies that would sell you open source software, because institutions wouldn't buy it unless they paid for
some companies. Well, in fact, I ran a company that made somebody. They're going to pay us, then okay.
Right. But I have another question, because, well, first of all, copyright and patents and stuff protects information. And that's kind of blown away classical economics, which is based on scarcity, on having a bushel of corn. I give you the bushel of corn, you've got the corn, I've got your money.
Right, and now you don't have the corn. That's a crucial part, right?
That's right.
You
don't have
the corn. Yeah.
And, you know, with information, I can give it to you, and you and I've still got it, and you've still got it, and it's not scarce. Which sort of implies that a more socialist, communist culture would be able to deal with that better. That's kind of a leap.
Yeah, library.
But well, yeah. But that's where my question. I mean, this is a long way around to the question of: are there other countries that are dealing with compensation in a way that's more sophisticated or fair or whatever?
Mainly no, except maybe for Cuba a little bit. And I'm not actually personally, I realize in that the anarchist book, I'm not personally a fan of the Cuban government, but I believe, and no one checking this, that they have a somewhat more liberal attitude to copyright, partly because we've imposed sanctions on them that, you know, that included intellectual property sanctions. And so they got more radicalized than they otherwise would have been. But aside from like exceptional situations like that, there's this movement around the world among the states and the corporations to, quote, harmonize the copyright laws. And by the way, the one thing we can all do is not saying that not use the word protection. Yeah, the copyright and patents protect information. If you simply substitute the word restrict everywhere where you would have said protect, it would be more accurate and it will always be grammatical. It actually works, try it. So for example, the US delegation to, I think, the World Trade Organization, at one point, a group of lobbyists tried to persuade the US Congress to tighten a certain copyright law and make it more restrictive. That failed. They then went to the World Trade Organization, persuaded them to do it, and went back to the US and said, well, we have to harmonize with international law now. And this is, so it's basically, it's becoming a monochromatic, single regime now, as far as the law goes. There are not really many bright spots in the world. I mean, there are still exceptions, but it's failing to become monochromatic. You might know more since you have to deal with these laws on a daily basis in the library and the publishing world.
Well, I can't really speak to the compensation issue because I think that's different than access. But I can say that other countries are ahead of the U.S. in providing digital access to public archives and public materials. In the U.S., the closest we've recently come is, you know, the recently torpedoed Google Books settlement, which would have provided proprietary control over, you know, our cultural heritage, to, you know, for lack of a better term.
However, from what I understand, Europe, I believe the European Union, has a online digital archive that provides access to books, paintings, artwork, that sort of thing, and it's supported and organized by the state apparatus itself. We don't have a parallel here.
Yeah.
I also don't think we'll see a parallel here. Not, I mean, for ideological reasons, and also because I don't think we're going to see the state fund massive cultural projects like that anytime soon. That's going to be done by the private sector for profit. Google may have kind of missed their chance at this point, largely because of copyright.
Yeah, they got sued.
They got sued because of copyright. Exactly.
Yeah.
There was an author's settlement that would have allowed Google to provide access to these copyrighted works and provide authors with a share, but it also would have allowed Google to de facto claim ownership over these things called orphan works, which are works whose authors can't be found to, you know.
Or the rights holder can't be found.
Yeah, the rights holder can't be found. So Google would have de facto claimed ownership over that and the ability to provide access to it. Part of what was supposed to sweeten the deal and make it more palatable to libraries and the public was that Google would have provided an access terminal at every public library, one access terminal at every public library for the public to be able to, view the works that were, contributed by hundreds of libraries nationwide. For anybody that actually works in a larger urban public library, we all know that that would not be a viable option. Also, it would have allowed Google to collect and profit from our, your browsing history, your search history, your privacy data that then they would sell. It was problematic in a lot of ways, but I do personally believe that that is the model that we, as a culture, we encourage and, facilitate. So that is what we'll see here. It doesn't have to be like that, though. Even, I believe, recently somebody posted on a library blog that North Korea even provides some form of a digital public library on one of their websites. That just basically, it's like Creative Commons. Just cite it. You can use it. You can reproduce
it. I think in the European case, though, that public archive is not, works that are still in copyright are not, it's not like you can download the whole thing and print it or something.
No, that's a totally different thing.
The
right to reproduce is different than the right to just read.
Right, which require, in other words, they have to be, there has to be digital restrictions management.
Yes.
This question of increasing digital restrictions management is where we're headed. Some major publisher just announced that they're going to have e-books that are going to self-destruct after 10.
HarperCollins.
So we're going to have this continued creation of artificial scarcity.
And there's a vice-like effect here because you can't have DRM, this digital restrictions management, self-destructing e-books with open source software, right? Because if people can hack the software, so in other words, they have to own your computer. It has to actually be them controlling the computer that you bought with your money to in order to make this work. So it's technologically, it forces a surveillance society, which is a really big problem.
It's a huge ethical problem for libraries because we ostensibly are the gatekeepers of patron privacy.
Yeah.
If we'll stand up for the Patriot Act, why aren't we standing up to DRM?
Yeah. Well, you are, so thank you.
I personally, but most libraries contract with Overdrive to provide ebook access. There is no other system. There is one case in which a Colorado public library, community college library, partnered with the Colorado Independent Publishers Association to actually own and provide access to ebooks online from independent publishers. But part of the condition is that the libraries put DRM restrictions on them. So even the alternative models still have these restrictions.
We've got a question.
Well, I actually have a comment. I personally think Google's just going to give up on books, and they should because their interface is so old that they should just give up. But they also made a mistake in the beginning, and most of these large libraries own the rights to the books that did Google. And Google has pushed in, and they have pushed sideways, and most of these books are now available on the the new Michigan website of Happy something.
Happy Trust.
And then also in archive.org. But speaking from the libraries, you know, we don't have the rights to these things. The authors own the rights. And I also, authors own the rights to their letters and to their manuscripts. And so I can provide access to these things, but I cannot provide copyright to those and the families of people who own the copyright. And it's very hard to, in this country, give away copyright. Even if you wrote something and you want to make it, it's not easy to give away your copyright. If you are a publisher and your publishing has folded and you want to go out there, Happy Trust is making it easier now. Brooklyn Museum, for example, has decided to make the books that they're not selling anymore that they have published, they recently have made them available. And they put, and the other ones that they're selling, they say 10 years from now we won't be selling this book anymore, and then that'll be available. But it's not easy. Some of these new models are allowing it to be easier to give away your copyright but still stay within the models where it's accessible through a library and on the website and not on some weird website somewhere else. So it's hard to, but we have to remember that the authors own the copyright, not the publishers. And so whatever the publishers,
well, publishers do,
well, some of them are given away and some of them are not. There are lots of people who never signed anything about an ebook that now their book is on ebook as an ebook, and they didn't know ebooks when they wrote that book. And so do they? I mean, I don't believe that they really do. I mean, I haven't seen the contract, but yeah, well, whatever. I mean, these big publishers will do whatever they want. But anyway,
most of those big publishing contracts say, you know, any medium now in existence or conceivable on Mars.
But there are, you know, there's pushing around, and I think we can't really talk about ebooks either because they're just, it's just so valuable. And maybe 5 years from now we can understand them. We can't understand them anymore.
But I know this might be dangerous words for the publishers, but I mean ebooks are the only books within your lifetime. The chopping up trees and pulping them to print books is like, never mind the environmental concerns, it's just, it's an expensive and dumb way to make books once ebook readers are cheap.
People will agree with that.
And there may be people who disagree. I'm stating it as an opinion, but it is at least, I believe, an educated one. Ebooks are books, and if we're not going to admit that, you know, it doesn't matter. The world is going through that anyway.
Well, most of the cost of traditional publishing in print is paper, printing, and shipping.
Yeah.
And if you eliminate those, the economics change radically.
Yeah.
Actually, I think. Oh, go ahead. I mean, that access to a computer, which is so environmentally degraded, like, it's not like making computers is that good for the environment, and like the pollution that comes from that. Like, access to computers is like, I don't think books are going to die, because the majority of folks in the world...
They'll die slowly. How many scrolls have you read lately?
I live in a privileged society with American citizenship, and I'm also like a white folk who has access to a job and money and a computer.
Right, but I mean, nobody in the world has read scrolls lately except for a few people who copy up the Torah. I mean, it's... you know.
Claytown was even less popular.
Yeah. I'm just saying, like, yes, but computers are getting cheaper. I do hear your point. Books will persist for as long as we're alive, I'm sure, but like, the dominant form of transmitting information is going to be electronic. And it is, even in countries that you wouldn't normally think of everyone having a laptop or something, like Africa is cell phone wired now. Nobody saw that coming 20 years ago. And now it's done. So they all have an ebook reader.
Yeah, I was just at a talk yesterday and saying that between 2002 and 2008 that the amount of mobile devices globally increased 60%. And it's unlike, you know, like things like laptops, those are certainly more common in privileged areas. But yeah, mobile devices are not as much of an elite technology. And I mean, yeah, there's environmental issues that are less graspable than just like, there's a lot of paper, a lot of trees made that. But I wanted to ask too, what do you all think is the essence of the reading experience? Because as texts become more what is it the font and design, and obviously I'm not talking about illustrated books or books of art, because that is different. And I wonder, do you all think that this is the sort of thing where our community continues to be sort of weirder than everyone else, where we do, you know, we like things like zines, we want things, or are we, you know, in radical communities, is it going to evolve into more like the container doesn't, and the format doesn't matter, that it is just the text and the content, or do you want to?
I think it's not specifically the radical community, it's frankly just people who are used to a certain physical experience of reading a book. I'm sure it was the same with clay tablets, you know, they're heavy, they're inconvenient, but, you know, it's just not a book if it's not a big old clay tablet. I mean, the next generation, I don't think, will be as attached to the paper books. And as far as the environmental impact of computers, it's not really a question of what has greater environmental impact, books or computers. We have computers and we have books. One of them can be basically packed into the other, the functionality of the one can be packed into the other, but... You know, we're going to have computers, but, you know, why pulp up trees while we're doing that? Computers, you know, do other things, and frankly, also making them books doesn't create that much extra environmental burden. Maybe we'll keep them on up longer and, you know, burn more coal and uranium and whatnot, but that's another question.
That's a good point. We're going to have them anyway.
I love paper books, though.
I'm missing terribly.
I do want to return back to the issue of access, though, especially from a library perspective, because a significant amount of New York City only has library access to a computer, and it's limited to an hour a day. So as we discuss, you know, distribution channels to radical ideas, we need to keep that in mind, that that there is a digital divide, that the transition from print to digital is going to last longer than our lifetime, and to keep a variety of channels of information available, you know, especially if we want to spread these ideas and get them, you know, into the small outlets that there are to, you know, access these ideas. Even if it's, you know, the small corners of the library you can get it into once in a while, the radical bookstore, because chances are that's how somebody is going to be introduced to these ideas if they don't have regular internet access, which a lot of people in the U.S. still don't.
Also, one other thing, and I don't know, Craig and Jim can probably talk about this more, is that when I got my royalty statement, I think I sold like a whopping like 3 to 5 ebooks this year versus, you know, the like, you know, like 200 or so copies of like the book with paper. So like, I think that maybe this speaks to like the fact that like people still are like, you know, like you go into a bookstore and you browse. I don't have an ebook reader. I don't know how it works, but I don't know how you then find out or stumble across something where you're like, oh, I didn't know this existed before.
It's the word of mouth, I think.
You know, but if you don't have like that, you know, like you're not in that circle of people that like might tell you about this thing, like would you ever know about this? So I mean, again, maybe this just speaks to like the weirdness of our community, where
digital,
like, you know.
But then you have to think of how many books that, you know, there are an infinite number of books that hasn't happened to you with right now that you don't know about because it didn't happen. That will always, I mean, you know, your attention is very limited compared to the amount of information out there, and that's true for every one of us. So there will always be way more and more that you can read, and that's fine.
Things will get increasingly pushed toward us digitally, too, though. I mean,
if they own our computers, yeah.
It's also for mass media providers, it's more profitable.
Yeah.
It benefits the publisher, I mean, the mainstream publisher, not the small publisher, and it doesn't benefit the author.
Yeah, Jim, you didn't mention labor in the costs when you said paper printing and shipping.
Well, that's because we're all free labor. Yeah,
but you're not, but you're the people that do the actual printing. I just think that like ebooks only does, it puts a lot more people out of work, doesn't it?
Well,
about a bookstore.
From our perspective, it would help put out of work the people who do our book printing, the people who ship our books, the people who sell our books in brick and mortar stores. They're all going to be endangered for sure.
And they are endangered now.
They are endangered,
You know, there's no substitute for a printed book. You go next door and look at those books, read them, hold them. It's a far superior experience to reading on a screen or a Kindle. We sell a lot of e-books, tons of them. You know, like most publishers are now 10% of our business. It's growing every month. Now that we have the Google deal and the Apple deal and everything else, Amazon's still by far the biggest and the worst. But they pay more than the other ones because the race to the bottom
you know, our contracts with Apple Books and Google say, hey, we're going to charge 80% of whatever Amazon does, so we can undercut them. So the author gets less and less and less money. And we have to put more and more money into promoting the books. Our costs aren't all in shipping and printing. They're in, well, someone designs the book, someone has to make it look good, and then someone has to do thousands of dollars worth of work to get the world to know about the book somehow. Because otherwise, if everyone can do their own book and they can put them all out on the internet, you know, how's anyone ever going to know about it? They won't. You know, you come up to the event there, and you know, we sell 50% of our books face-to-face with people. We sell 50% through Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Greenlight Bookstore, St. Mark's Bookstore, Blue Stockings Bookstore. You've got to have both.
There's never been a greater tool for word of mouth on the internet, I think. It may not be your experience with a particular kind of book.
It's not my experience. It's definitely not the type of sell.
In general, you know.
I think it would be a, you know, a really sad, lonely world if everybody read on a computer.
Well, Autonomedia's crack promotional and marketing division has always been very skeptical of advertising. Though clearly advertising, I guess, is, you know, good for sales. I don't know, I like the idea of having kind of self-publishing, do-it-yourself model where blogs are available, you know, in vast quantities. I'm not sure, one of the ways in which the politics of media has been cut is that we need gatekeepers, and we need to have somebody who decides this is a valuable media product and this one is less valuable. But I don't like that model so much, really. I'd much rather have greater choice, maybe infinite choice.
If I can point to the experience of our artist in residence, whose economic success, as well as artistic, I have to say, I referred to earlier. So she made a movie, not a book. But it's useful to just look at the economic model, because basically readers, those viewers, do just send money. And the average donation is $30. And she's made tens of thousands of dollars this way. It's a very good movie. But it does sort of mean that you don't need a gatekeeper. There's no distributor that ever decreases what happened. And if you chop out the like high donations, you know, the rich person who sent 1,000 or 250, you get everything 250 above out, it's still $10 average. I think that an economic model that requires one person, one organization doing the marketing, one organization in charge of all the shipping, trucking, pulping of paper and stuff, even the readers don't want that. And when they really love something, they will support that author. They will not let that author starve. It doesn't mean you're thrown back on the quality of your work, but ultimately I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Tristan?
Since we've been coming back to this idea of distribution and the differences of distribution between an ebook and a regular book, I think we also need to keep in mind that there is a method of distribution on the internet. It's called your wireless, your cable, things like that. So that also is a product of our economy that we need to keep in mind, and that as long as we are using ebooks, we're dependent on our internet providers. So that's just another area that if we want to have full control over our media, we would need to step in and take control of. The U.S. is, compared to Europe, it's incredibly bad. Like most of the U.S., you only have a choice between one or two internet providers. Right now, most places you get a slower rate for higher pay than places like rural France, where they have 16 options and they get faster internet than you do right here in New York City. So the internet is not a neutral place. That's just what I want to keep in mind.
So we've got about, I don't know, 10 minutes or so. Sorry, it's like the band is moving. Are there other questions? Final thoughts and statements from anybody?
How many people in the room are authors? Have any of you considered releasing your works under open licenses, free licenses? I'm curious. I'm not going to judge you in the answer. I was just curious.
Are you asking me specifically?
No, but I guess I'm facing you. So.
Right. I haven't thought about it yet, okay. But I'm not supposed to.
Right. I think the copyright starts with the author, so that, you know, the way an individual makes a difference is if you give the audience freedom, I think that it can make a difference systemically.
Well, you know, I've never thought about open licensing, but I've thought about simply, putting things up online and selling the physical copies and asking people kindly not to print their own. You know, so, you know, if you want a physical copy of the damn thing, you know, send me some money and I'll send you a book. I think that's actually a good medium in trying to, you know, hit that lottery jackpot in a book that people actually buy. And also relying on the free distribution of people who, want to read your ideas but don't want to pay, which are often people who would see your book anyway, maybe borrow it from someone or get it in the library. Do you really care if, you know, it's they read it off of a computer because you put it up, or they borrow a book from someone? Either way, you're not getting paid. But, you know.
I think a middle ground like that, whereas I think that's going to become more common, in which, you know, you'll see small print runs as kind of like a legacy, as kind of an ode to the book, like LPs are now. They're collector's items. People love them. They buy them because they want to own them and display them, not necessarily because that's how they listen to music. They may still, you know, download music for free online and load things up that way. But I think the idea of trying to create artificial scarcity with digital material, that is what is going to change, because it's indefensible. You can't maintain it. You just can't.
They're trying hard, but
it will not happen. But I do think we'll see parallel, maintenance of print culture as you know, a cultural choice.
Yeah. Mm. And in that
we
kind
can
of
make
culture,
those choices.
The author will always be the seller of first choice.
Exactly.
Like, anyone would rather, if you could buy an LP directly from the band, you would always do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think the parallel here is the music industry. The music industry has been going through these changes for the past 20 years, and, you know, most musicians at this point do not make the bulk of their income from sales of product, unless it's merch, you know, they tour.
Yeah.
We're going to have to come up with alternative compensation systems if we want to still maintain access.
We'll get a Resistance Behind Bars t-shirt.
I do think we should, it is normal and reasonable to expect that at any given time in a reasonably prosperous country, which for the moment we still are, it's normal that the majority of artists will be starving artists. Because it's all, you know, if you have the option of driving a truck or trying to make a living as a writer and you can just barely scrape by, you'll give it a try. It's always more attractive. So there will always be an oversupply of artists. We shouldn't look to the presence of starving artists and struggling writers and such as in itself a sign of a problem that must immediately be rectified. Of course, I want them all to have lots of money. I want everyone to not have to worry. But, you know, it's a systemic thing. We'll always try.
But it also exists within the context of our culture, where we do have a mass devaluation of labor, period. You know, deprofessionalization, the increasing creation of contingent, part-time, and free labor. Mm-hmm. And that's going to influence the experience that we have as workers within a creative or an intellectual economy. We're not unique, you know?
Any other final thoughts from panelists or anyone else?
Thanks for putting this
together. Okay. Yeah, no, thank you.